Before we begin with closing arguments, let's just deal with a couple of housekeeping matters. At the conclusion of yesterday's proceedings, counsel for both sides and I talked a bit about the issue of trying to obtain access to the UK litigation. I expressed my practical concern about issuing a subpoena to a foreign court has already ordered things sealed. As Mr. Wickersham put it, that he did not want to precipitate a Boston Tea Party incident. I am in complete agreement with that. So I think the way the parties plan to proceed is to work together and give us a report at the next Autism Omnibus Status Conference, which is the 20th of November. At that point, I would hope that we would have a fairly complete list of what it is that we want from the British files, consent obtained from those individuals who have filed reports to the extent that they're willing to give it, and a pretty good handle on what other documents besides expert reports, if there are any, that we want to obtain, and as well as a clear and cogent statement of what we need to, why we would like to have this material to assist in this litigation. And I understand there are several other hoops that need to be jumped through, but that the government is going to work with petitioners in ensuring that they understand how the procedure went last time so that they can duplicate if possible. Is that a fair summary of what we talked about?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then this morning we talked briefly about what happens after closing argument today, and that is the briefing schedule. Much as you all were tempted to just make oral arguments and then dispense with the brief, we all have shared a similar desire. Gee, could I just rule from the bench and not have to write this opinion? But I don't think that's going to work for any of us. So for that reason, we've come up with some dates, and the 23rd of January is a due date for petitioners' post-hearing brief, and the 10th of March as a due date for the respondents' post-hearing response brief, and that seems to fit with the schedules of both parties for both sides, as well as what's happening in the Phase 2 omnibus proceeding. Correct? No problems with those dates?
That's correct.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Are there any other matters we need to put on the record then before we go into closing arguments?
Only that you did graciously come down and meet that my client, and our client, I should say, respectively, Colton Snyder. And just on the record, I'd like it noted that Colton is with us this morning together with his brother and sister.
Well, welcome, Colton, and I understand you may get civics credit for this. That's a good thing. It's nice to have an opportunity to see the court system in action, particularly without having to watch a friend or someone else being arraigned. this is a good part of the court system, where we help people try to resolve difficulties rather than deal with criminal misconduct. All right. I met Colton's brother and sister, who are also present in the courtroom. With that, let's go ahead and move into closing arguments. And Mr. Powers, I understand that you're going to make the closing argument.
Yes, thank you, Special Master.
And since, obviously, we don't have the opportunity to forego written submissions, and obviously the recitation of the facts and the review of the evidence in those written submissions is going to be very detailed and lengthy, I will truncate the closing and not even attempt a thoroughgoing summary of the evidence and the testimony and the science that we've heard, but rather sum up the case. And sum up the case, and I hope put it into context in terms of the autism proceeding. Because this case, as we all know and has been repeated throughout this hearing, is about Colton Snyder and resolving his claim, but it's also an important case that will give guidance to the parties and particularly to the special masters to resolve 4,800 claims, or some portion of those 4,800 claims, in the omnibus autism proceeding. At the outset, in my opening, we talked about biological plausibility. and biological plausibility, particularly given the standards of proof, and the burdens of proof in the program, is an important concept. And we promised you in the opening that we would show that the theory we've proffered here is biologically plausible, and we've met that burden. We've lived up to that promise. Biological plausibility here revolves around several issues. One is in describing viruses generally. Viruses, from the testimony that we've heard, often do have new and novel and unexpected effects. They often have effects and consequences that cannot be predicted simply based on their structure. You can't always base what you know about a virus and what it might do in the future with what you have observed it doing in the past. And I emphasize observed what happened in the past, because, as we know, things might have happened and have happened in the world in general and in the world of viruses in particular, happening over and over again, happening many, many times. Nobody knew that it happened. At each of those events, you could say, there's no published study describing this phenomenon. There's no evidence describing this phenomenon until you finally look for it and you find it. So the fact that throughout respondents' expert reports and testimony, you've heard that, well, there just isn't evidence to support this particular theory or sub-argument to that theory. In many cases, it's because people either haven't looked for it or they haven't found it yet. But the plausibility, as I'll detail a little bit more, is there. I mean, a classic example, you heard Professor Kennedy, Dr. Kennedy, talking about how the HPV can cause multiple things, completely not predicted by the structure of that particular virus, and that's what we saw going on here. You then narrow it down to measles virus. We've heard testimony that makes it sound as if so much of measles virus is predictable. And in the majority of cases, it probably is. We talked about the exposure time, the viremia, what happens when it's in the body, its cycle of life in the host, the symptoms one would expect. And it makes it sound as if it's all known and predictable and coded and inevitable, and that's the limited universe of what can happen with measles virus exposure. But you look a little bit more and you actually see that there are a number of exceptions to that. You have, from the HIV studies, the case control studies, you find out that actually measles virus can persist in a body for 60, 90 days and perhaps even more. And as the technology gets more sophisticated, you start finding it there longer and longer. So, you know, it doesn't clear quite as quickly as we thought. You see it causing diseases like SSPE and MIBE. Again, very, very different than the normal course of a rash and the other things that one would expect with a typical street virus or wild virus infection. We've seen reports from the CDC talking about encephalopathy and other neurological injuries associated with administering the MMR. And sure, they're rare and they're unexpected, but they happen. We've even heard that the measles virus can sometimes have a curative effect from respondents' own experts. Curative effects that, again, one would not predict based on what you knew about the structure and the life cycle of that virus. So it's not a neat, orderly progression in all cases. There are new and novel outcomes. And from my reading of the science and the experts that we had on the stand describing their reading of the science, those type of new, novel, and unexpected outcomes are being pursued and are being discovered in the world of measles virus and in virology in general. And some of this shouldn't be that surprising. We've heard the process by which wild virus is converted to a vaccine strain, the attenuation process. We've heard that by respondents' expert referred to as a black box, that after 45 years of intensive study, mean, you've seen the articles that are generated. You have literally an industry that has been making this biological product, the vaccine strain, for 45 years. And some of the core processes remain a mystery. And given that black box of what happens as you attenuate and mutate a virus to form a new, less virulent virus, that black box also shuts off what we can see about a process that may very well contribute to exposure causing the type of symptoms we see in this case. There is nothing about the properties. There's nothing innate to the measles virus that precludes it being able to cause the type of injuries we see here, and there's nothing innate about that virus that means SSPE, MIBE are the only possible sequelae. There are other outcomes, and this is one of them, and that's what the evidence has shown. We talked also about persistence and replication, because bottom line, everybody in the room knows that the central theory in this case is that vaccine strain, measles virus, actually, in fact, persisted and replicated in Colton's cerebral spinal fluid and ultimately in his brain. We've put on evidence and heard a huge amount of debate about evidence identifying measles virus RNA detected in Colton in his cerebral spinal fluid, and that again as proxy for in his brain. The virus was there much, much later than one would anticipate. Much, much later. And it's not lying there inert. We know that it was replicating. We know it was replicating because the proteins were identified. The F gene, as Professor Kennedy described, was identified. And that's a gene far enough along in the sequence to tell you that whatever viral material in there was not an artifact or debris from a previous exposure. It had to have been replicating, and it was replicating in Colton's spinal fluid and in his brain. Dr. Griffin's work that was discussed in Cedillo and cited a couple of times here indicates clearly that the persistence issue and the replication issue can be established through the presence of RNA, and particularly RNA accompanied by proteins. So, with measles virus in Colton's brain, it's more likely that it was doing something in his brain than it is likely it was doing nothing. And what it was doing is described by Dr. Kinsmore. What Dr. Kinsmore described to you was a model. It was a model of neuroinflammation with concrete neurological symptomatic outcomes. In the brain, as Dr. Kinsmore describes, the presence of the measles virus triggers the body's system, immune system primarily in the brain, activating microglia, releasing pro-inflammatory cytokines, setting off a chain reaction that ultimately results in a fundamental disequilibrium in the brain's ability to function, the overexcitation of the brain, creating neural noise, so to speak. I don't think you heard that term from the stand, but in Dr. Kinsborn's report, he describes the neural noise that's caused by this excitatory, inhibitory dysregulation and the overexcitation. He then is able to describe how that neural noise creates the need for a child who's experiencing that to behave in ways to adapt to the reality inside his brain, and that's what happened with Colton. So Dr. Kinsmore's model is not only biologically plausible in its neurology, in its neuropathology, but it's plausible at both ends. That is, it both is consistent with and explains a measles exposure at the front end, and it is explanatory and consistent with the symptoms one sees at the other end. What we see here is also a time sequence, cause, and effect. And this is where particularly the testimony of Colton's family and caregivers, medical caregiver and speech therapist, is crucial. That evidence establishes that Colton was a neurotypical little boy up until 15 and a half months of age, meeting his developmental milestones, rolling over, sitting up, standing up, walking, interacting with his parents, interacting with his family, playing with his siblings. Motor skills, social skills, interpersonal skills, and communication skills entirely consistent with a typical course of neurological development. And he maintained that course from birth almost to 16 months. And as hard as respondents' experts might want to go back in time and scrutinize seconds-long snippets of video to identify potential expressive language deficits, this is a child who was getting well baby visits really his entire infant life. And the record is consistent from the medical providers not identifying any problems like that at all. You remember there was one note that at 4 months he wasn't rolling over. That was it. By the time he goes back, he's right on track, and by the time he does his 1 year, he's right on track with a specific note that he shows no receptive language delays or disorders. So this was a neurotypical child up till he got the MMR, and he was not a neurotypical child after that. That is, the medical records and the testimony here, contemporaneous records, make it clear that this was a different boy after 15 and a half months. And again, given the petitioner's burden and what we need to prove in establishing causation, that sequence, the time sequence, is important. And in this case, it's not just important, it's dramatic. And you've heard the testimony on that. There's obviously, moving on to another issue, a huge debate here about the reliability and credibility of some important evidence in this case, and that the core evidence in this case is the evidence of measles virus persisting and replicating in Colton for a significant period of time after his MMR. Petitioners are relying on the lab results from Unigenetics, and we've seen a sustained attack, as we did in Cedillo, on the reliability of the Unigenetics results. Couple of comments on that, without even getting into the issue of what you, Special Master, talked about early on, the possibility of getting more information from the United Kingdom. But just based on what we have here, a lot of this attack is tenuous. It's a house of cards with hearsay, built upon hearsay, built upon hearsay. Somebody sees a document, tells somebody else they saw a document. That person then reaches some conclusions, tells somebody else about it, and then somehow it ends up here. A chain of hearsay embedded within hearsay, and hearsay, not even necessarily in the technical legal sense, and we're not here obviously to debate the rules of hearsay because they don't apply in the program, but it's important to remember that the rules about hearsay exist because they are indicia of reliability. And when folks who supposedly have developed an extensive documentation or critique of a particular idea aren't willing to come in and present that, and it's being done in proxy, so to speak, it makes that attack on the O'Leary lab less reliable and less credible. I think it's also important to remember the testimony of Dr. Kennedy and Dr. Kinsborn to take into account their credibility and their reliability. And I think one of the core things that, if I imagine myself as the disinterested observer, seeing those two gentlemen testify, aside from their qualifications, aside from their experience, aside from the fact that they're both smart guys, the striking thing about their credibility is that they are happy to tell you, Special Master, what they don't know as well as what they know. They are willing to admit of uncertainty. They are willing to admit when they run up against a thought process where their certainty dips down below 90 or even below 50. They don't overreach, and they confine their conclusions to what they believe can be supported by the evidence. And that makes them credible. That really is a summary of the evidence in this particular case. It's briefed ahead of hearing, it'll be briefed after hearing, extensive evidence, but that in a nutshell is the evidence that you've seen here for the last 4 days. The evidence about Colton Snyder is evidence that you'll use to resolve his individual claim. But the evidence that you've heard here is going to reflect on how a lot of these claims are resolved with the Cedillo case, the Hazelhurst case, and now Colton Snyder's case, all coming to having concluded hearings and now the process of briefing and opinions being written. The petitioners respect that process, and the petitioners look forward as we move through concluding decisions on these three cases to lining up the next round of cases. And one thing that I just want to always emphasize is that as lawyers, we talk about these as cases. They're claim numbers. They're a petition number. I think we have to be careful and remember what these cases are really about. And I think our witnesses have to be careful about what these cases are about. These are not abstract cases. These are real kids with real injuries. And I respect that the special masters clearly recognize that. But on behalf of my clients, the clients that I personally represent, and the folks that I represent collectively as a member of the PSC, I always want to make it clear that it is about children with real injuries, and we're talking about science, and we're talking about facts, talking about experts, talking about documents. You have to bring it all in and apply it to the child and to the facts of that child's medical history. And when you do that in these cases, and particularly when you do it in Colton Snyder's case, given that dramatic presentation of regression after administration of the MMR, that is powerful, compelling evidence of causation. And based on that evidence, as well as all the other evidence in the case, we urge you to find that Colton Snyder is entitled to compensation on his petition in this program.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Mr. Matanowski, are you arguing for the respondent?
Yes, ma'am. Although I think Ms. Esposito was a little concerned when she got the seat at the front table here.
You were throwing her into the fray.
I noticed when I walked in today and pulled out a big sheaf of papers that there was a bit of a concern on everybody's face that my closing argument might be fairly lengthy, and I think I noticed a visible sigh of relief when you saw just a couple of sheets of paper here. I hope to be brief. That always, you never, as a lawyer, seem to be able to do that, especially when you get the stage. I'd be remiss, however, if I didn't start at least by acknowledging the Snyders and their participation here, our appreciation for that, and our care and concern for the family. There's kind of a wall that's built between us for the government and the families. It's by rule or ethics, we don't get a chance to express or talk or interact with them. And this is really my only opportunity to say that we certainly appreciate and understand. We read the medical records. We listen to the testimony. We see the families, and we know what they go through on a daily basis. And certainly understand that and feel compassion for them. And that's certainly true in this case. I'd also like to thank the court, because I know that you've paid attention through these 4 days of testimony. Now this fifth day of trial, and 4 days before that in the Hazelhurst case, and 12 days of Cedillo. I know it's been a long period of time, a lot of evidence, and it's been clear that you've listened carefully to that, and we certainly appreciate your attention to both sides of the case. There's been a discussion about the burden of proof, and I seem to detect at the beginning of this case maybe a little shift to a little bit more emphasis by the PSC on the burden of proof. And I wanted to make sure there isn't confusion about the burden of proof and the quality of evidence that goes into the to meeting that burden. The respondent has been driving home, I hope, that the evidence that you have to look at on complex scientific issues needs to be measured as to its reliability. That measurement of reliability isn't a 50% measure. That's a separate idea about whether something is reliable on a scientific basis. Only if it's reliable does it feed into the ultimate question about whether or not there's causation and the burden. The burden has always been 50%, if you will, 50% and a little more. That was true in Daubert. That was true in the Daubert progeny of cases. The quality of the evidence that goes into that burden is a different matter. The PSC has laid out a theory here that has multiple steps. And rather than going through, obviously, 20 days of evidence on those various steps, I thought I'd pose a series of questions that I think come up when one looks at that theory in its separate parts. And I think you really have to answer that, yes, the petitioners have convinced you on each step before you can find that there's causation in this first theory that MMR and mercury causes autism. The first question is, do you believe that mercury in the amounts contained in vaccines causes immunosuppression, any clinically relevant immunosuppression? Do you believe that based on the testimony that you've heard from doctors Byers and Apashian against the testimony that you've heard by doctors Brent and McCabe? Do you believe that measles virus causes clinically significant immune suppression? Or do you believe the testimony of the experts that respondent put who work in the field of measles day in and day out and what their observations have been? Do you believe that mercury or that measles virus persists in the brain in a way never seen before, as Dr. Kinsborn hypothesizes? Do you believe that it persists in the brain but does not cause cell destruction? Do you believe that it persists in the brain and gives clinical symptoms entirely distinct from subsclerosing panencephalitis? That it manifests in symptoms that are unique, those symptoms that are unique to autism? I think Dr. Rust explained the differences fairly convincingly, at least in my view, during the Hazelhurst case. Do you believe that it persists and causes inflammation in the brain when that's not seen in subsclerosing panencephalitis? Do you believe overall that the mechanism, the injury mechanism, that Dr. Kinsborn postulates is reliable when he himself, in the Cedillo case, described it as the weakest part in his whole chain of causation? A chain of causation which many of the separate parts he described as hovering at about the 50% confidence interval for himself. And specific to this case, do you believe that measles virus could persist in the brain, cause an immune reaction, as Dr. Kinsborn hypothesizes, and yet not result in measles antibody when that was measured in Colton's CSF? Mr. Powers has said, well, measles virus could act in a new and novel way, one never seen before. I believe that that really is almost coming word for word from Dr. Oldstone's writings. We heard that a lot in Cedillo. We've now heard from Dr. Oldstone and what he believes about this theory, this postulate. Do you believe that it could act in this new and novel way, as petitioners say, when three, and if you count Dr. Oldstone, four preeminent experts in the field of measles virus have come in and said, we research it. We want to see it in new and novel ways. We're looking for that, and it does not behave in this fashion. Doctors Ward, Doctors Griffin, Doctors Rima, and now Dr. Oldston, if you choose to accept that, say, it does not behave this way. If you were going to look for the measles virus to behave in a new and novel way, would you look to those people who are studying it, or would you look to Dr. Kennedy, who's written one paper based on his review of those very experts we presented in terms of finding out whether measles virus could act in a new and novel way? Do you believe the Unigenetics test results are reliable? And do you believe that when Unigenetics, if it gets a positive, it can get a positive result when no reverse transcription process is performed? And we know that that has to be done in order to find this type of RNA. Do you believe that you can trust the Unigenetics results when you know that when confronted with a zero copy number for a sample, and then that same sample get a copy number that's, say, 2400, they ignore the zero and take just the 24. Would you trust the lab results from a lab that operated in that fashion? Do you believe the Unigenetics results when they report cell counts that are physically impossible? You can't cram that much genetic material into a cell. One thing that has not, its focus has not been on it recently because it certainly is not going to be part of the petitioner's case, and we've been in the last two cases responding more to the petitioner's case, and that's the epidemiologic evidence, and it's, I think, an appropriate time to go back to that and think about it a little bit. Do you believe that epidemiologic evidence that shows that MMR vaccine is not associated with autism can be wholly ignored? The IOM didn't believe that. They looked at it and concluded, based on that evidence, that there is no link. I would be remiss in talking about it. There's been some dispute about the Unigenetics results. We don't think there really is any dispute about it, but there. We heard, what does Dr. O'Leary think? And he's not here, obviously. He's not been presented by petitioners. And I think there was some discussion about hearsay. And I assume, with respect to Unigenetics, that discussion about hearsay was about Dr. Oldstone's testing, if you will, of Unigenetics. It certainly couldn't have been about Dr. Reams or Dr. Buston's testimony. They looked at the lab results. They looked at, they had actual access to the lab. You know, they weren't telling you what someone else told them was going on there. They were looking at what was going on there. So it must have been about Dr. Oldstone and what he said and what communications may have gone back and forth between O'Leary. I think in all this, there may have been some, people may have ignored a piece of evidence that the respondent has put in the Cedillo case, and it's a newspaper article that quotes Dr. O'Leary in 2004 and what he had to say about his testing in the lab, and that was response to simple exhibit AAA. He said, when talking about the Unigenetics testing results, and I'm going to take a quote from that article, quote, the testing continued until late 2003, and reports were provided to Alexander Harris and to the UK court on our findings. They did not support the MMR autism hypothesis, end quote. I think that convincingly tells us how reliable the Unigenetics test results are for the proposition that they've been put forward to for in this hearing and in these test cases generally. That is, whether they could possibly link MMR to autism. Dr. O'Leary himself said that they did not. The testing at Unigenetics did not do that. Now, in wrapping up, I'd just like to say I apologize if at some points there seems to be some passion to our defense of the case, if our exuberance at times may lead us to perhaps overstatement that may, hopefully it didn't offend, maybe at times it does. It certainly is, I've tried to be dispassionate. A couple of weeks after, I just give you a little anecdote, a couple of weeks after the first trial, I bumped into a friend and he said, I read about a case you're doing in the newspaper. And that had never happened before. Toiling away for 16 years in vaccine work and even more working for the United States, I never had anybody say to me, oh, I read about a case you did in the newspaper. And I have to admit, a little bit of vanity. I was interested to hear that and said, oh, what did you read? And he said, they described you as colorless. So I didn't want to be colorless, but I hope I haven't maybe stepped beyond the bounds at times and been a little too exuberant. But a vigorous defense is warranted here, and a certain amount of passion in what we do. And I think we ought to be passionate about it, because what we do is important. Obviously, what Mr. Powers and Mr. Wickersham do is important, but also what we do for the United States is important, because the stakes are very high and important for both parties here. It certainly is true in every case, and I know it's abundantly clear to the court in every case that it's important to the petitioners before you. I've done these cases for 16 years, and I felt that every single case was important to the petitioners and can recognize that. I know that. Here, however, I think the spotlight also shows how important it is in terms of the decision and making the right decision, not being swayed necessarily by appeals to more personal emotions, if you will, and looking at it based on evidence alone. Because this case is under this, there's a spotlight on this case, and what you do obviously will be viewed by many people as indicating whether or not vaccines are safe. Now, that's true in every case, but here the spotlight is on. It's brought it to our attention that what we're going to do is going to be looked at closely. So I won't apologize for vigorously defending this case. It's an important case. I believe that we've put on reliable evidence that shows that the vaccine is a safe vaccine. It does not cause autism. And I have every confidence that the court will apply that evidence and make the proper decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Matanowski. Mr. Powers, did you wish to make a very brief?
Extraordinarily brief,
I'll buy. Okay.
Yeah, and I do appreciate the your indulgence to let me respond, as is often traditional in a civil setting, a brief rebuttal close. And just addressing a couple of issues that Mr. Matanowski raised, talking about the credibility attack, so to speak, on the Unigenetics lab, it's important to remember that when we hear that documents were reviewed someplace, it's important to remember that we don't see the documents here. And evidentiary rules about having the complete record and being able to put things in context and being able to track the history of events, particularly detailed events that matter at a laboratory, is significant. And we don't have that here for a number of reasons. What is a problem with the respondent's case is that so much of their testimony, including much of what we heard from Dr. Rima yesterday, is based on conjecture and assumptions based on very, very limited bits of information, assuming that if an error happened once, that it's a pervasive error, that if a mistake is made, it's a pervasive mistake, that if contamination happens once, it A, isn't properly addressed, and B, happens repeatedly, assuming, without evidence that it happens. And if you look at what's actually documented, particularly in the Unigenetics issue, it's a much narrower universe of alleged errors
than one might be led to believe if you extrapolate it out. So I just wanted to raise that point, and also the point that in one of the respondent expert reports, Unigenetics was described as a purpose-built laboratory, with the implication that it was built on behalf of litigants. It was being operated with folks in by folks with a stake in the outcome. That's how I read the purpose-built description. It's also important to remember that in the UK, there was a massive purpose-built attack on that lab, paid for and organized by the pharmaceutical companies that were at risk of liability in that system. And that purpose-built defense has been imported and is being used here. And not that it's inappropriate to do that, but it's just important to remember that when one side is described as purpose-built, it often applies to the other. And those are just issues that you ought to consider in weighing the credibility and the reliability of the evidence. One last note. I just wanted to talk about the issue of epidemiology, because Mr. Matanowski is right. It was really focused on, at least in Cedillo, fairly extensively with Dr. Fombone's testimony. I was going to say I vigorously disagree, but it's not me. The scientific community vigorously disagrees with any statement saying that epidemiology can prove that there's not a cause and effect. As you know, and the evidence that we heard way back in Cedillo, is that it's about associations. And epidemiology can't conclusively prove the positive or the negative. So that issue, and I think it's more than a semantic issue. As we start talking about this and you get your brain into the science and you're looking for certainty, I think there's an urge for some of the science out there to be functional. So to have the epi say, yeah, give me an answer. You know, I'm going to dump a bunch of data in here and please give me an answer on causation. It's just not going to get you there. Final note on epidemiology, and this again came up extensively in Cedillo. There really hasn't been a study done to look at this problem for progression, particularly in Colton Snyder's case, looking specifically at a population of children with regressive autism symptoms and examining associations with the administration of the MMR. Study hasn't looked at that. The design, the size, and all the other issues that were aired out in Cedillo on the studies that have been done tell us that that epidemiology is not particularly informative to resolving a case like this with this presentation of symptoms. And we understand, as the petitioners, the importance of the case and the decision here. The Snyders, just as was the case with the other folks in the other test cases, are not anti-vaccine. Again, these are the folks that vaccinated their children. And nobody on this side of the case is saying you should stop doing that. And fortunately, thimerosal is now out of the pediatric vaccine supply, and that's good news. But I do agree with Mr. Matanowski that whatever the outcome of this process, it certainly ought not to be that vaccines are inherently bad and to be avoided. That is not the message here, and that's not the message you're going to send by weighing the evidence and rendering a decision that awards compensation to Colton Snyder.
Thank you very much. On behalf of my colleagues, I want to once again thank the Snyder family and for coming forward and being the test case, the third test case in this first theory advanced on causation of autism. I want to commend counsel for both sides for their presentation in this case, and I want to specifically thank the Wickersham and Bowers firm for coming forward late into this process and in 5 months getting this case ready to go to trial, obviously with the able assistance of the Petitioner Steering Committee. But it was important for purposes of the program and for how the Office of Special Masters approaches these cases to have the benefit of three cases that have presented very different
patterns for us that will result in a far better product, I think, from our office as we work to get decisions issued, again, emphasizing that each special master will decide only that special master's individual case. I'm the fortunate one who gets to go last, and so I've seen all of the evidence in all of the other cases, and it's clearly all before me. The issues of what evidence the other two special masters will be considering is still a bit up in the air. We have a briefing schedule. I don't anticipate that I know that there will be no decision issued before the briefing schedule. I know that it will take some time to issue the decision even after the briefing is concluded, and that we do have the specter out there of additional evidence relating to the UK litigation and the Unigenetics lab that we will discuss how that comes in. I'll emphasize again, as I did the last 2 days, that it is time to stop talking about what we wish we had and make every effort to get it. If we can't get it, we'll resolve the case without it. That's what, nobody has a perfect case. But we have indicated our support for the parties obtaining whatever additional information from the UK litigation, from the experts who testified there, or not testified, but filed reports and may have filed other documents. We certainly support that because it is important not only that we come to the correct decision in our individual cases, but that we come to the correct decision, period, recognizing the impact that these decisions have on future cases. So with that, again, I thank counsel for both sides. It's been a pleasure working with you, and I look forward to reading those post-trial briefs. We're adjourned.
Thank you.